It's Steve Grenville here. It's my pleasure today to introduce Sebastian Mallaby, who's best known for a book on the World Bank called The World's Banker and a book on Alan Greenspan, former chairman of the Fed, the man who knew the life and times of Alan Greenspan. I'm going to try to move us in the direction of current events, which is mainly about how President Trump will interact with the Fed. We have the situation where Janet Yellen's time will be up in January and there are three vacancies on the board. So there's a lot of room for President Trump to influence the board. And just interested in your view of how much of that opportunity will he use?
I think the first thing to remember is that Fed independence in the United States is a tradition, a habit, but it's not in the law. And it's actually a tradition that's about a quarter of a century old and not more than that. And so the idea that Trump would influence the Fed and its policy is not that radical. I mean, this was just the normal thing that happened between the late 60s and the early 90s. I think he will take the opportunity presented by the three current vacancies, plus the fact that Janet Yellen will go early in 2018, plus the vice chair, Stanley Fischer. His term is up in the summer of 2018. So five of the seven positions on the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors can be filled by Trump appointees, and I'd be surprised if he didn't use that to put his own stamp on the institution.
What would that stamp be? He's a former property developer, so his inclination might be to have low interest rates and heat the economy up a bit.
Yes, I think that's just right. I think that there are three reasons why Trump is a loose money, low interest rate kind of president. First is, as you say, he comes from the real estate sector, the most interest rate sensitive sector. Secondly, he proclaims that his target for American growth, he said 4% in the campaign. His Treasury Secretary modestly says 3%. Even 3% is way above the median estimate of the sustainable growth rate from the central bank. I mean, the median member of the Fed's Federal Open Market Committee has an estimate of 1.8% for the sustainable non-inflationary growth rate. So Trump is targeting extremely high growth, which will cause him to want lower interest rates as well. And thirdly, we have to remember that Trump's political base was to win swing voters who are manufacturing, blue-collar workers, also in interest rate sensitive and particularly currency sensitive sectors. So obviously, low interest rates, other things equal, means a weaker dollar. Weaker dollar is good for the manufacturing sector. So I think for all these reasons, Trump is biased in favor of loose policy.
What damage do you think that would do? After all, America doesn't have an inflationary problem. Unemployment is historically fairly low, but probably a little bit more could be squeezed out of a hotter economy. What damage would it do if Trump's influence is to make monetary policy easier?
I think the thing is that easy policy may not show up in inflation, except in asset price inflation. The price of eggs in your local grocery store may be stable, but Nest eggs, not so much. And I think this is part of the pattern of the evolution of the economy since the Second World War, that, you know, in the first few cycles after the Second World War, you had a typical pattern of inflation picking up, the Fed tightening to push it down again, and the higher interest rates causing a recession. And that was the sort of the normal business cycle. I view the early 90s as a kind of transitional moment when it was partly that, but also there were balance sheet problems and a commercial real estate bust that caused the recovery from that recession to be rather slow. So there was an asset price dimension to it, a balance sheet dimension to it. Then you go forward to the NASDAQ crash in 2000 and the shallow recession that followed that was another clear case of a sort of asset cycle driven recession. And of course, 2008 was the extreme example of an asset price correction leading to a recession. So I think that what we're learning is that in more recent times, as the inflationary bias has been squeezed out of the US economy because expectations are well anchored in inflation terms, the labor market is de-unionized, so there's less upward pressure on wages from union bargaining, and because of more openness to imports, which compete prices downward, and perhaps also because of technological change and the substitution of labor by machines. All of these things mean it's harder to generate inflation, not impossible, but harder. So what tends to happen, it seems to me, is that what bites you first is asset price inflation, not consumer price inflation.
I want to tease this issue out a little bit more because it's very relevant for Australia also. We have inflation below the target, below the Reserve Bank target, but we clearly have asset price pressures in the housing sector, and the stock market's doing quite well. What do you think the lessons from America might be for Australia in handling this rather unusual situation for a central bank?
Well, I think the first point is, as I was saying, it's not totally unusual. I mean, I think, you know, we think of it as unusual. We think of 2008 as being this black swan. But actually, you know, post-2000 was a similar story, and 1990s had a little element of that too. So I think the first lesson from American history is that it isn't unusual for financial cycles to turn out to be more problematic than business cycles. And the second thing I think is that, you know, inflation targeting shouldn't be the absolute mantra. It's a very tempting mantra because after the 70s, it was such a victory to stabilize price inflation, and central bankers understandably don't want to mess with that success. But it isn't adequate. If the purpose of a central bank is to stabilize growth over the medium to long run, I don't think you do that by only focusing on price inflation and ignoring asset price inflation.
Could I use the opportunity to squeeze you a little more on that in terms of what's happening in Australia now? Inflation below the target, economy a bit slower than we would like it. This would imply that interest rates ought to be lower still. Do you think the Reserve Bank is not taking the opportunity to get interest rates as low as they should be, perhaps because of fear of asset price inflation? Where do you think they should come out on that issue?
Well, on Australia specifically, I'm going to duck your question because you know more than I do. But I will say, as a general matter, what I think is, having studied the US example and also looked at a few cases like Sweden, is that if you tighten interest rates at a time when your economy is operating below potential, you won't be able to sustain that. That's what happened in Sweden. So what happens is you tighten because you're worried about asset prices, then the real economy weakens further. Then you have to loosen because you're, you know, frightened of a recession. And then you've lost all credibility with respect to scaring the asset markets and trying to take the froth out of a bubble. So I think the only times you can use interest rates to fight an asset price overshoot is when you are at full employment. That's where I think the US is now, by the way. I think, you know, with 4.4% headline unemployment, we have full employment. We have growth which is above what the Fed estimates to be the sustainable rate. Therefore, I think that now is the time for the Fed to tighten, even though inflation is below target. So in the US case now, I think it's like 1999, which was another case where inflation was at or around target, but asset prices were going crazy in the tech bubble. It's also like 2005, when inflation was fine, but the real estate sector was going crazy and the Fed tightened much too slowly, I think. So I think there are moments when the central bank can fight asset prices and should do so with monetary policy. But perhaps if Australia now has growth below the sustainable rate, now is not such a time for Australia.
One of the things that struck me reading your book on Alan Greenspan is the close relationship between the chairman of the Fed and the political system. For instance, he met once a week with the Secretary of Treasury. We find that unusual. How do you read the proper relationship between the political side and the central banking side?
Well, in the US context, I think history teaches that central banks can't pin their independence on some idea of technocratic purity. You can't hide away in your ivory tower and say, I'm a technocrat, I'm an expert, leave me alone, I'm going to do my thing. Because the politicians will come after you and they will not accept that. So what happened with Greenspan when he was attacked by politicians, and you know that happened under the George H.W. Bush presidency in the early 1990s and late 1980s, Greenspan, when he was punched on the nose by the Bush team, punched them back twice as hard. And so central bank independence, I think, was cemented, even established in the US context, by Greenspan's political savvy, by his ability to brief the media and have the media on his side, to talk to the markets, have the markets on his side, to talk to members of Congress and get the White House's legislation blocked if he didn't like it, by just teaching the White House that picking a fight with Alan Greenspan was a losing proposition. And so it's this model of, you know, I set out to write this biography of Alan Greenspan. I thought I was writing a biography of the premier sort of financial statesman of the post-war era. And it turned out that I was also writing the biography of one of the outstanding Machiavellian operators of recent times. And that was the surprise that I encountered.
I can't resist asking this one on Greenspan. He started out slowly enough, but became the maestro. He was the maestro in this job of looking after the Fed. By the time he left, many people thought that he had perhaps been a major cause of the 2007-2008 financial crisis. Supposing he had left after 10 years instead of staying 15 years, I think he was there at least 15, 18 years, there's no doubt his reputation would be in better shape. Do you think America and the world would be in better shape?
You know, that's a very good question. I do believe that term limits are a good idea for any very senior position like Fed chairman, because I think that what happens is that after about, you know, 7 or 8 years on the job, all of the senior staff positions, the directors of the key departments, are people who you've appointed yourself and therefore are not probably going to think that differently to you. And that's too unhealthy. There's too much of an echo chamber. It becomes too easy to get into your groove and not question what you're doing. And I think certainly Greenspan over time became less willing to think out of the box, you know. And so I think it's good that Ben Bernanke stepped down after 8 years. He didn't have to. Probably could have had another term if he wanted it, but he didn't want it. And I think that's a good thing. So, yes, if Greenspan had left earlier, it would have been better for his reputation. Would it have been different for the country and for the world? Now, that's a really interesting question because it hinges on whether Greenspan made the mistake that led to the financial crisis of 2008, or was it sort of a generational mistake, a consensus in the economics profession that turned out to be wrong? And I think it was the second. I think that another Fed chairman would have followed the same basic policies of a kind of unannounced inflation targeting mindset, would therefore have tightened rates very slowly in 2004-2005, believing that, look, inflation is behaving itself, so we don't need to tighten any faster than this. And I think this would have had exactly the same effect. In other words, an enormous bubble. Because I think that at the time, given the glut of savings from China, it was necessary to tighten with especial aggression to counteract that savings glut. And I think the combination of slow tightening and excess forward guidance, I'm not always a fan of forward guidance, despite its popularity. I think those things encouraged leverage on Wall Street and inflated the last stage of the real estate bubble, which then came back to bite.
This is fascinating stuff for an ex-central banker, but I must also ask you about the World Bank. I don't want to do that in a way that makes it more general. President Trump has America first. How will he interact with the Bretton Woods institutions such as the World Bank and the IMF? Will he cut back their power, and will that have a big effect on the rest of us?
You know, he's already announced in his budget proposal that he wants to cut foreign assistance quite radically. He's fundamentally not interested, I don't think, either in the idea of American sort of soft power projection and American stewardship of international institutions. It just doesn't speak to him. I mean, if you look at his view of the global trading system, that's where it's the most obviously hostile. His instincts really are protectionist deep down. His first instinct on NATO was to say that it was not needed. He's now revised that, but that was not his instinct at the beginning. And I think in the same way, you know, we're going to see a continuation of what was already the case of the US being less good at leading the international global institutions, therefore allowing space for China to push ideas like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank. And Trump will, you know, if Obama allowed that to happen, I think Obama should have embraced the Infrastructure Bank, by the way, and I think possibly if he'd embraced the World Bank more and allowed more space for China within the World Bank and the IMF, perhaps China wouldn't have felt the need to go and set up its own institution. So I think this has already been a problem of American leadership falling short. I think Trump will just add to that.
Sebastian Mallaby, it's a real pleasure to have had you here at the Lowy Institute. We look forward to seeing you again. Thank you.
Lovely to be here with you.